how has tourism and writing about travel contributed to the ecological degradation of the planet? How does language influence perception and our relationship to the more than human world?
Michael Cronin is an Irish academic specialist in culture, travel literature, translation studies, and the Irish language. He has taught in universities in France and Ireland and has held visiting research fellowships to universities in Canada, Belgium, Peru, France, and Egypt. He's a fellow of Trinity College Dublin, an elected member of the Royal Irish Academy, and a senior researcher in the Trinity Center for Literary and Cultural Translation.
He's the author of Eco Travel, Journeying in the Age of the Anthropocene, and other books. Michael Cronin, welcome to One Planet Podcast and the Creative Process.
Thank you.
Before we dive into the conversation, you're going to read from your book, Eco Travel. I'll just set up the passage you're going to share with our listeners.
Right. So this comes from the introduction. So it's kind of introducing the principal argument behind the book. Nobody lives on Henderson Island in the South Pacific, an isolated and uninhabited coral atoll. It was designated a UNESCO heritage site in 1988 in recognition of its unique ecological character. It is the kind of remote ecological island Eden that has enthused the imagination of travelers for centuries. Remote, inaccessible, different, alluring. Henderson Island has also gained the unenviable distinction of having the highest density of human-made debris on the planet. Almost 38 million pieces of plastic have been found on its coastline, and each day that passes brings 13,000 new pieces ashore. In the North Pacific, Midway Island, one of the most remote islands in the world, lies at the center of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, a huge concentration of plastic litter covering a surface that is almost three times the size of France. Islands that formerly offered visions of unexampled environmental plenty are now a witness to unparalleled ecological devastation. Traveling there is now less about establishing an inventory of delight than drawing up a catalogue of loss. More specifically, is there a sense in which the inventories of delight have prefigured the catalogues of loss? How have travel and writing about travel contributed to the ecological degradation of the planet? Conversely, what role has travel writing played in making readers aware of the climate emergency and the need to promote sustainable forms of engagement with a planet in crisis? To begin to answer these questions, we need to reflect on how travelers' perceptions of the environment have changed over the centuries.
Yes, indeed. Just go into that more. You know, how have travel's perceptions of the world changed over the centuries?
I suppose to some extent, the initial period of travel, and this is from the Western perspective, was very much driven by that kind of Renaissance imperative to see with your own eyes, to only believe what you could see. And there was a kind of curiosity about expanding knowledge of the world. And so this led people to explore different parts of the world. It wasn't, of course, only intellectual curiosity. It was also economic opportunity and imperial ambition. So these, if you like, tend to run alongside each other, the spread of empire, the increasing engulfment of the world by the economic market, but also the desire to explore and know this world using the instruments of Western science. So really, for a very long time, the way in which people got to know about and hear about and become aware of the wider world was through people writing about travel. At the end of the 18th century, the most popular genre of all was travel writing, because travel writing, if you like, provided people with the sort of the news, the kind of verbal video clips of the planet. So how people imagined the Arctic, how they imagined the Americas, how they imagined the Far East, how they imagined Southern Asia, so much of that was fed through travel writing, because travel writing was something you could access in your own home, in the local library. It was the cheapest and most accessible form of knowledge about the world. So it becomes hugely important in shaping the environmental imaginary of people in many parts of the world. What begins to happen in the 18th century with people who are writing about islands that have been colonized and have been subject to particular kinds of monocultural exploitation, whether for coffee, sugar, minerals, or whatever, that things are beginning to go wrong. The first sign is deforestation. When the trees, if they're cut down in sufficient numbers, this leads to a dramatic soil erosion through flooding, environmental catastrophes of one kind or the other. So we begin to find writers in islands like Mauritius in the Indian Ocean who are beginning to say there's something going wrong here. We need to think about this. But really, it's when we get into the 20th century, and particularly the mid-20th century, that we begin to find an exponential increase in the number of travelers who in remote and distant places begin to see the environmental effects of intensive practices, whether this be deforestation, whether it be mining, whether it be the cultivation of monocultures. So we see it with somebody like Fairfield Osborne with Our Plundered Planet in the 1950s. He begins to describe what's beginning to happen worldwide. But in order to do that, that involves travel to different places and using the travel account to talk about environmental degradation. And I think that what we're entering now is the third phase of this evolution in writing about the planet from a travel perspective, which is we're beginning to ask ourselves questions as to what extent travel itself is bringing about the end of travel, that the environmental, the ecological consequences of mass air travel are having catastrophic consequences on the environment, consequences that are, of course, mainly borne at present by people who have contributed the least to this environmental crisis. So now I think we're moving from what I called in the first part of the book, the ends of travel, like thinking about what we might use travel for, to now the end of travel, ? To what extent can we still write about travel in the way we have up until now?
Indeed, with billions of passengers taking flights annually, you know, air travel contributes about 4% to human-induced global warming and doesn't take into account the additional impacts on biodiversity and ecosystems to the destinations they visit. So it's just not sustainable. Although I just want to say on a positive note, looking forward, it's not quite developed yet, but we are looking towards the future of perhaps green hydrogen-powered flight. And I'm only mentioning this because yesterday we had again on our show Bertrand Piccard. Did the first, as you know, the first round the world solar powered flight, but they're planning in 2028 to do the first green hydrogen powered flight. So hopefully we don't have to make those difficult decisions, but we do have to definitely consider them, as you say. Can you elaborate how the concept of the Anthropocene and how that impacts our relationship to travel and also, which has been another part of your work, our understanding of translation?
Yes, I think the fundamental feature of the Anthropocene is that our relationship to what I call the more than human world has changed dramatically. The sort of paradigm that obtained in the West, this wasn't the same in other parts of the world, but in the West was very much the idea of a pyramid. And at the top of the pyramid, you had the sort of the white European male, and everybody else in the kind of was subordinate to this white European male. And the idea that was central to this pyramid was a kind of a mixture of the Judeo-Christian legacy and the Cartesian legacy. So the Judeo-Christian one was basically the idea that when Adam is in the Garden of Eden, that he is given dominion over all things on the earth. He's given the right to kind of name the plants, animals, creatures, and so on. So it's the idea that he is in the superior position and that the rest of the living world is subordinate to this naming person. And of course, the idea was that man was different from animals, that he was made in the image of God and had a soul. And this is an idea that is then perpetuated in Christianity. So you have this idea of a kind of a divine approval for this hierarchy. And then what happens in the 17th century is Descartes comes along and he says that, well, we can no longer base the difference between humans and animals simply on a question of religious belief, we need to come up with some other explanation, because there's increasing kind of secularization of the world and the devaluing of religious explanation. So he says that really what makes us different, and he takes this idea from Aristotle, this notion of the logos, that what humans have is they have the capacity to reason and they have the capacity to speak, and they speak this human symbolic language. So what that means then is that what fundamentally distinguishes humans from other animals is they have the capacity to speak, and they have capacity to speak a particular kind of language that allows us to express the results of our rational thinking. And all of that's very much concentrated in the mind. So we talk about Cartesian dualism, and the mind is a superior entity because that sort of defines our humanity, and the body becomes kind of subordinate to it and just carries out our instructions. And the rest of the living world is seen as something that is basically a kind of an inert object that's subject to the thinking and the operations of the active human subject, the active human mind. And of course, it's around that time as well that we're getting all kinds of scientific explanations for the features in the natural world. So whereas before, if there's thunder and there's lightning, the explanation would be that the gods are very angry with humans because they did something bad. Now scientists come along and say, we can explain this using the principles of atmospheric pressure, moisture, electricity, currents, and so on. So this is what we call the de-animation of the world. The world becomes a kind of an inert object of scientific inquiry. So basically what we find then is that the animals, the natural world, the living things in it, the rivers, the mountains, the forest, these become instruments of that we become, in Descartes' words, masters and possessors of nature. And this is what basically is called into question by the climate emergency. Because in the climate emergency, what happens, this is why we've got it, we talk about a new geological epoch, although there's still a bit of controversy about whether, in fact, we have actually arrived there. But what characterizes our world is that the sum total of human actions has the same force as a geological event. So the eruption of volcanoes, the shifting of tectonic plates, these are things that have traditionally, you know, had a huge impact on the Earth, on the environment. But now the sum total of human activities is having an equivalent effect. So what's happening, of course, is that alongside this, we find that the idea of a kind of an inert world that is simply there for our pleasure, enjoyment, and exploitation, it has proved to be catastrophically mistaken, because we see it with flooding, with forest fires, we see it with acidification of the oceans, we see it with the continuing rise in temperatures, is that the world itself, the more than human world, is fighting back. It has taken on its own agency. And that therefore, the idea of a pyramid, a hierarchy, is no longer operative. So what a number of what are called post-humanist philosophers have suggested is that we need to look at horizontal relationships, not vertical ones. So in other words, we have to see ourselves not in a hierarchical position with respect to the rest of the living world, but to see ourselves as in a symmetrical partnership with the plants, the trees, the forests, the animals, the microorganisms, etc. And so we have to think about not vertical relationships, the ones we're accustomed to, but to think about horizontal relationships. And that, if you like, is where the challenge comes. For me, for example, in the case of translation, it occurred to me that if we are thinking about horizontal relationships, so if I'm thinking about the relationships that I might have with dogs, with a cattle, with mountains, with forests, etc. You know, I'm talking about relationships between such radically different things as a dog, as a forest, as a stream. So what we're basically talking about is, because all relationships imply some form of communication, is a communicative relationship across radical difference. And one of the things, of course, that translators have had to think about for centuries is how do you communicate across radical forms of difference? And for me, one of the challenges in a lot of various post-humanist philosophy was that you cannot take relationality for granted. It's not going to happen magically, that if we're going to rethink how we relate in a more horizontal way to the more than human world, then we have to think very, very hard about how we're going to do that communication, how we're going to cope with radical difference.
Yes. And speaking of forms of communication and relationships, this is something that many Indigenous cultures do, you know, instinctively. Firstly, they don't see themselves as separate from nature, but rather as part of it. I am the tree is me, and so on. And we see ancestral wisdom and Indigenous knowledge. It's not about ownership and domination, but it's about respect and ecological relationships. And to help us orientate and know a little bit about your story, can you describe how your bilingual upbringing in Ireland with its unique combination of English and Irish helped shape your perspective on the world and influence your eventual path to translation studies?
Yes, yeah, no, I think to some extent it's no accident that we get involved or are passionate about certain things. And I can certainly kind of trace a line back to my childhood, because my childhood growing up in Ireland was, for me, this, I often describe it as kind of stereoscopic or binocular experience, where on the one hand, I was living in a minority language that was the indigenous language of the island for more than 2,000 years, and a language that has about 200,000 speakers who use it on a daily basis. And then I was also speaking a language which is a sort of a hyper-international language spoken by hundreds of millions of people across the planet. English, which was introduced into Ireland as a result of the colonial settlement and occupation of the island, has now become the majority language of the people living on the island. So you have this experience where you were living in the same place, but the same place, for example, was named in radically different ways. You know, the city Dublin takes its name from Dublin in Irish Gaelic, which means the
Black pool.
You know, the main park, the biggest public park in Europe, Phoenix Park, English, the Park of Sionishka, the Clearwater in Irish. The street where my office is called NASA Street, in English, named after a colonial adventurer. And its name in Irish is Throids on Haberforig, Patrick's Wells. So in Irish, all of these names are intricately linked to water. You're moving through a landscape that is deeply infused with the presence and the memory of water, but that is completely different in English. You're occupying a set of references and symbols that often refer to the colonial past or to other parts of that more recent history. So I think, if you like, straddling two worlds, one world that is deeply embedded in Indigenous understandings of place and story and name and so on, and the other language that was deeply embedded in a kind of globalizing modernity. So that experience, I think, made me profoundly interested in two kind of areas of inquiry. One was translation, what happens when you shift, when you move from one world to the other. And the other is travel itself, you know, how the landscape and the ways we think and we inhabit it are profoundly shaped by the languages that we travel in and the languages in which we experience a particular place. Because what I tend to find is that you find a great deal of historical accounts, geographical accounts, sociological accounts of mobility and displacement. But one of the things I noticed over the years, which, if you like, made me write a book on globalization in 2003 and on translation identity in 2006, was how remarkably absent language and language difference and language contact was from these stories of human mobility, despite the fact that one of the most fundamental experiences that humans have when they move from one space to the other is precisely the fact of language. Language is very, very fundamental to their experience. But I certainly found in the 2000s, when I started writing about this, that this was almost completely absent from the global agenda in talking about these phenomena.
And so, of course, your third language, and I'm not sure if you have others, but you've said that you found French to be an extremely powerful language insofar as it allowed you to access new bodies of thought and literature and gave you a new way of thinking and then opened up conceptual terms. You also write about films and books in translation and identity and what will translation and eco-translation look like in a digital age. So I'm just wondering if you just describe the ways that these new languages opened up your empathic imagination.
Yes, I think that the role that French played, which is a language I came to in high school, was fundamentally kind of a conceptual one. It was a language that I did two things. One, it provided me with access to a philosophical and intellectual tradition that was very different from the ones in English or in Irish. So it was just ways of thinking about the world that were radically different from the ones that I had encountered. And I think secondly, there was a sense in which the more I immersed myself in the language, it was easier for me to be able to think more conceptually about the world. It's like that by virtue of immersion in this language, that it helped me sort of hone or develop a particular kind of analytic or intellectual skills that wouldn't have been available to me in English. And of course, it's very difficult when you talk about language and language differences. You're always compelled to generalize. And of course, there are always exceptions to any of the arguments you might make. But I felt on the whole that whereas English provided me with a very strong commitment to evidence, to the empirical, to the careful study of phenomena in a quite sort of descriptive way. And what French provided me was big picture thinking, was the ability to globe things in a more conceptual way, to pull away from the kind of the forest of particulars, to see things in ways that were clearer, where you could extrapolate the common problem that was underlying a lot of problems that looked very diverse on the surface of things. So I think that kind of thinking has very much informed the way in which I think about translation, for example. So I'm less interested in the kind of the close philological reading of how, you know, the French imperfect is translated by the continuous past in English, how you would deal with specific cultural references going from one text to the other. I mean, I find that a lot less interesting than seeing how translation functions at a macro level in societies. In other words, how does it impact the politics? How does it impact the economics? How does it impact business practices? How does it impact forms of literary expression in societies? To show, if you like, that it's a core activity rather than some kind of marginal, peripheral activity that's mainly the concern of philologists.
Yes, I found the wonderful thing about the French is they have an endless curiosity towards other cultural experiences. It's like you say, the big picture, that they really intellectually embrace a multilingual and multicultural world. And I also lived in Ireland for many years, but sadly never managed to hear very much of the Irish language being spoken. But it's interesting what you were saying about the Irish names of places and their deep association with water.
Yeah, this question of linguistic relativism, what extent the languages we speak determine our vision of the world. I suppose I subscribe to sort of a weaker version of that. I don't think that it's all determining, but I think it's can be a very important contributory factor. And I think that the way that works for me in two ways. One is grammatical and the other is mnemonic. So let me start with the mnemonic first, the question of memory. One of the things that speaking a language does, and particularly when it's a language that's been spoken in a particular place for a very long period of time, for a continuous period of time, is that it immediately links you to the continuous history of that place. Because every time you see a place name, you see a name that not only describes a specific feature of the landscape, but it's also a place name that has stories associated with it. So stories that, if you like, go back to the kind of the pre-Christian or the pagan past of the island. So there's a sense in which you situate yourself not in some kind of moment in the present where you're sort of cut off from all that's gone before you, but you're in a kind of continuous mnemonic relationship with that past. So that the past, both in an environmental, in a more than human and a human way, so human story and more than human environmental features of the landscape, they are present to you. Just like when you see particular animals, so when you see foxes, when you see dogs, or when you encounter particular trees, and there are all kinds of stories and legends that are associated with those animals and with those trees and a certain kind of attributes and qualities. So that's very much present in your mind. And the other, which is to do with the more purely formal properties of the language, is that I notice with certain things, in Irish, for example, if you were to say, I'm angry, you say, which means literally that the anger is on me. Right? So in other words, it's on me now, but it can potentially go away. It's kind of, it's a momentary state. But what it suggests is a relationship with anger. In other words, an anger that may come because it's on me now, but it can also go away. Whereas I find with the I am angry in English that there's something kind of definitive, final, and static about it, which seems to close off relationships. It's more like some inherent ontological attribute of the person as opposed to a relationship that you have with this emotion. And so many of the words, the way we describe emotional states in Irish, are based on that notion of relationality and also based on the notion of change, of kind of continual evolution, transformation, and so on. So for me, I find it's those sort of dynamic properties of the language are most interesting in allowing one to have a different experience of the world. Because I think to some extent, I'm always reluctant to create some kind of hierarchy of languages to somehow kind of valorize indigenous languages over different world languages. I'm not interested in that kind of hierarchical ranking, but what does interest me is that we all costs preserve the linguistic diversity of the planet because every language just provides this unique way of experiencing the world. And that's why we need to actively struggle to maintain them in all their diversity.
Right. So you've talked about linguistic translation, but I wanted to take it back to deanimation for a second and ask what you think about the translation of frameworks. So how do you think traditional ecological knowledge and indigenous perspectives and frameworks could revolutionize our techno-scientific understanding of nature and mobilize communities and governments towards climate action?
I think there's sort of two aspects to that question. I think the first is one of the things that has dogged the translational engagement with indigenous peoples and indigenous languages for centuries has been this instrumentalist framework. Basically, the idea that you engage with the indigenous language, you write the dictionary, you produce the grammar in order to extract what you need from that culture, whether it's knowledge about where a particular resources, or whether it's indoctrination to make them part of a workforce, or indoctrination to make them part of a religious group, which is the religious faith community of the colonizer. So this translational paradigm was the one that has been so dominant for so long. What interests me is the way in which a lot of indigenous communities are now, if you like, reappropriating and engaging with that translation process, but are doing it on their own terms. In other words, from what I would describe as translational hermeneutics rather than translational instrumentalism. So in other words, that what these translational practices whereas the indigenous people themselves are doing the translation rather than having other people do it for them, is to reveal, not to reduce the plurality of meanings, but to expand the plurality of meanings and what texts and ways of thinking about the world are that are present in those texts, and which, if you like, are bound up with those horizontal relationships with the more than human world rather than the kind of the vertical ones that I was talking about earlier. So I think that kind of move to hermeneutics of translation is very important in creating this new kind of paradigm. And the second part of your question.
Yes. How can we use this to mobilize communities and governments towards climate action?
Yes. One of the things that has arisen in recent years in the area of political science is what they call post-Holocene governance. The traditional idea we've had with democracy is this kind of notion of the public sphere or deliberative democracy, where we're there, we engage with each other, we try and collectively decide what's the best thing for our group to further the interests of all the people in the group. This is the sort of the ideal. And of course, this notion of kind of a democratic ideal then gets critiqued by various groups saying, okay, so certain genders are excluded from this deliberative democracy. People of color have been excluded from this deliberative democracy. So you go to the various groups in order to expand this notion of what a genuine democracy is. But what many eco-activists are arguing now is that in order for us to live on our planet, we need to greatly expand our understanding of deliberative democracy to include the more than human world, to include all of the entities in this world that we share. So in order to do that, then, It seems to me that we have to think about forms of translation, forms of interpreting. Who is going to speak for the river? Who will speak for the mountain? So I can give legal personhood, as has happened in Ecuador, New Zealand, and elsewhere, to a river or a mountain or a forest. But then we have to think carefully about who is going to do the translating. And this is precisely where indigenous peoples have such an important role to play. Because for centuries, indigenous peoples have seen themselves as being involved in a translational relationship with the more than human world. They accord character and personhood to the different entities that they interact with. And therefore, it's a question of acknowledging the differences. It's not a question of pretending that you as human can just project everything onto the more than human world through kind of anthropocentrism, the Mickey Mouse view of the universe. But it's more the idea that you communicate across difference, you respect difference, and you negotiate that difference. And it seems to me that that translational knowledge of indigenous peoples in different parts of the world is something that we need to think about in terms of how we might develop a kind of translational politics for what's called post-Holocene governance. For example, rather than a Security Council, you have an Earth System Council, where the different parts of the world with different sort of biomes that they would be represented at this Earth Council. But it wouldn't, of course, just be humans. It would be animals, living organisms, non-living organisms. So we have to think about the sort of the politics of representation, just as different groups, just as we've had to think about it over the centuries in terms of humans. We now have to think about it, I think, in terms of the different groups or categories in the more than human world.
Yes, it's very exciting to think about that in terms of it, the big revolution in this last 18 months or so has been, of course, generative AI. And of course, that's opening up different pathways where I believe, I don't know what your thoughts are, we need governance and guardrails to protect and honor human contributions for society. But other possibilities are being opened up in terms of developing ways of communicating or understanding the language and the grammar of non-human animals. So I just wonder what your reflections are on that. And as you imagine, a world where a council has representatives and translators from this more than human world.
Yeah, well, I think on the one hand, it is very interesting. There is a lot of interesting work in the area of cetacean communication, the kind of the Earth Species Project, the work that's been going for many, many years that Colin Slobodovich has been doing with prairie dogs and using early versions of AI to look at communicational patterns. I can only imagine that work will increase and become more and more important over the years. The one thing I would say, however, is, and this is why I think it's really important to have translation studies perspective or the experience of translation studies here, is we need to be very careful about how we ethically construe translation, because one of the forms that could possibly come from the use of advanced AI to develop communication systems that would allow us to communicate in a particular way with animals, it could be the further exploitation of animals and different species and different parts of our more than human world. In other words, there are two very different histories in translation. One is the history of diversity, opening up contact to other peoples, other places, curiosity about other languages, other literatures, and so on. So that's the bright side of translation. But equally, there's a very, very dark side of translation, which is the way in which people's languages have been learned in order to exploit them, enslave them, torture them, encircle them, dispossess them. So translation is not in of itself intrinsically always a good thing. It is something that is extremely powerful, but what you have to think about is the ethical ends to which you use this. So if we think about the use of enhanced or advanced AI in translational programs as a way of revealing, for example, the cognitive or the epistemic complexity of particular ecosystems that we should at all costs try to preserve. So we use this as a way of preserving the kind of ecological complexity and diversity of the planet. well, then you could say that it's being used to good purposes. But if, for example, we were to use translation systems with domesticated animals to further control and limit their movements and to further facilitate their use for us as products of manipulation or consumption, well, then it's a completely different picture that emerges. So I think it's extremely interesting, certainly a story to follow. I think it certainly has potential benefits, but I think all the time we've got to think about the ethical frames in which we're going to carry out this kind of work and ask ourselves, to what purpose in the end? Is it for the flourishing of the more than human world, or is it simply to further the extractivist profits of humans?
Professor Cronin makes some fascinating points about travel, languages, and our relationship to the non-human world. Take language, for example. Professor Cronin's division of linguistic relativism through mnemonic aspects and the formal aspects really resonated with me. My name is Evelyn, and I'm an associate producer on this podcast. I grew up in Italy to an Italian-American mother and a Dutch father. I grew up learning Italian, English, and Dutch. Learning these various languages helped me see the world differently. Take how we express love, for example. In Italian, in non-romantic relationships, you say ti voglio bene, which literally translates to I want good for you, which focuses on the object of the feeling rather than the subject, as it does in English. A distinction which I believe can truly help shape our experience of feelings such as love. When Professor Cronin spoke about the formal aspect of languages in terms of linguistic relativism, I immediately thought of gender. In Italian, as with other Romance languages, gender seeps into every conversation, whether one is talking about a person or an object. A table is masculine and a chair is feminine. A plate is masculine and a bowl is feminine. So how can we apply post-genderism, or the movement to think beyond gendered identities, into gendered languages? How do gendered languages uphold patriarchal societies and values? For one, Italian makes the masculine the norm. If there's a group of men and women in a room, they will automatically be referred to as the masculine. For example, when saying hello to all, one would say ciao a tutti, even if there were women in the room. If one were to say hello to a group of only women, one would say ciao a tutte. I could give many more examples of this, but I wonder about how the formal elements of our language uphold values that are frankly outdated, and how to balance the need to rewrite rules to fit our changing society while also respecting the elegance and beauty of the traditions of languages. Professor Cronin also fascinatingly talks about the need to radically reimagine the university when it comes to the need to convey the urgency of the climate crisis. Professor Cronin talks about the options of inverted or elemental universities. I think we also need to reimagine the university's role with investments in fossil fuels. Not only are universities not adequately teaching the scale of our crisis, not leaving spaces for students to navigate climate grief and inspiring them to imagine real solutions, universities themselves, especially in the US and the UK, are directly contributing to the climate crisis through fossil fuel investment and fossil fuel funded research. In recent years, there has been a growing call for divestment from fossil fuel companies and companies that fund fossil fuel production. In college, I led a divestment campaign at Columbia University, a school that had partially divested from fossil fuels. This was one of hundreds of divestment campaigns around the world that were met with both support and debate. In November of 2022, a spokesperson at the University of Pennsylvania, also a target of divestment campaigns, said that, quote, selling fossil fuel investments does not end fossil fuel production or create clean energy alternatives, and it risks transferring ownership to buyers who may care little for the environmental consequences of their actions, end quote. Yet what does it say when universities are helping students prepare for their future while also investing in the very thing that risks all of our futures? Further, university research is tainted with fossil fuel money. Luckily, student organizing and campaigns such as Fossil Free Research, which has now become the Campus Climate Network, have worked tirelessly to reimagine universities in their own way, as places that invest, both monetarily and intellectually, in our futures, instead of invest in the planet's destruction. Now, back to the interview.
And you're talking about that ethical considerations and reimagining our institutions. You've said that we need to radically reimagine the university. So what are your reflections on the lack of holistic climate education in schools and universities? And what do you imagine as a way forward?
Yeah, I think that it's time to be radical about the shape and form of our universities. I'm struck by a certain lack of urgency. This crisis is something that imperils our species, and we bring down a lot of other species with us on the way. But given the scale and the urgency of the challenge, what strikes me is that the universities of the world are basically, it's business as usual. And what I mean by business as usual is that it takes two forms. One is that every single university on the planet now has a mission statement that has the word sustainability in it. So it means everything and it means nothing. Its words become so, every university will have a green campus policy, which is a good thing. I mean, it's very good. That we think about reducing energy consumption, that we recycle waste, that we look to disinvest from fossil fuels. So these are all very good things. The difficulty, however, is that it seems to me that their contribution is so small compared to what we need to do. And I think one of the things we've got to do is to rethink the form of the university itself. I mean, just to give two very small examples, I've often thought about the paradigm of what I call the elemental university and the paradigm of the inverted university. So the elemental university is that if we think of earth, fire, air, water, right? So say the fire is energy, those kind of four elements, which, you know, appear in all kinds of mythological systems around the planet. If you had a water faculty, fire faculty, an air faculty, an earth faculty, and you had philosophers and biologists and physicists and historians and English literature specialists in each of these, right from the get-go, right from the start, the students would be immediately immersed in the ecological reality of their planet. Right? Whereas at present, the best you can hope for is you get one module in your first year or in your final year called sustainability in the 21st century or resilient living for today, which is inconsequential and tokenistic. Whereas if you actually reimagine the university where that structurally it is embedded in the ecological structure of our planet and how we ourselves are intrinsically caught up in that. I mean, the reason that I'm talking to you now is because oxygen is being released as a byproduct from the photosynthetic activities of the plants outside my window here. So I depend for my second-to-second existence on this more than human world. But how often in my university education am I going to really come into contact with that fact? So the elemental universities is one way to think about this. The other, the inverted university, or sometimes called the inside-out university, is one of the things that has been commented on by a number of thinkers, is how much of our thinking occurs inside boxes. We go to preschool, and we're in the preschool box. Then we go to primary school, and we're in another box. And then we go to high school, and we're in another box. And then we go to university, and we're in another set of boxes. And if we're fortunate and we get employment, we'll either get a corporate box or a state box to work in. So almost our entire lives, we are insulated and cut off from and screened, literally, in every sense of the word, screened off from the world, the more than human world. So the idea of the inside-out university is that both architecturally and logistically, to have as much of education and instruction carried out in contact with the outside world, right? So rather than students cut off from, that they actually would be out there in the world. So seeing the more than human world as itself the ultimate learning environment, but you learn about by being in it rather than learning about it by being detached from it. And of course, the more that you're in it, the more you become aware of the consequences of certain ecological actions. So if you're out in one of the really heavy downpours that we're having now as a result of climate change, if you're sitting outside learning, that's going to be much more of a learning experience than if you're sitting inside and you see the rain splashing against the windows. But basically, I think that it's time that we move away from university greenwashing to a much more fundamental reimagining of the university for a changed world. Because the thing about universities is so many people are so busy and so consumed in their daily lives by trying to hold down a job, feed their families, pay their bills. They don't have the time. They don't have the resources to be able to engage in that kind of long-term thinking that we need for our society. Universities do. They do have those resources. And, you know, it seems to me that an optimal use of those resources is a radical reimagining of what the campus would be.
That's a great answer. Thank you for that. I have a follow-up question to that, which is, in thinking about this inverted university in a more immersive sphere, how does that kind of tie into what you were saying about travel and eco-travel? In a more inverted university, in an immersive sphere, you might want to travel with your university, through your university, to different areas of the planet to kind of see what's going on in a climate change perspective. How does that link into your idea of eco-travel?
I think one of the things that it does is that it makes you think again about how we view travel. One of the distinctions that I made in a book many, many years ago called Across the Lines, where I was looking at people traveling through different language spaces, was sort of a distinction between what I called horizontal travel and vertical travel. So horizontal travel is the kind of travel that we tend to think about when we think, like, so I'd like to go to visit New York, so I could take a plane, or I'd like to take a train in Paris and go to Greece, go to Athens. So that's our traditional way of thinking about travel. But another way of thinking about travel is thinking about traveling vertically, where you stay within a particular place, but you actually begin to travel downwards rather than travel outwards. So one of the experiments that was carried out by a French novelist in the 1990s called François Maspero was he took the commuter train from the Paris airport in Roissy into the city center. And normally that's a trip that would take you about five minutes. And what you tend to see are lots of high rises whizzing by you, and you stop off in different stations that all look pretty much the same as each other. So what he did is he took that trip, but rather than spending 45 minutes, he took 3 months. And what he did is he stopped off in each one of the stations, spent 2 or 3 weeks in the area. And what, you know, becomes apparent in his book, Roissy Express, is the extraordinary kind of cultural and linguistic diversity, the life stories and the histories of all of the different peoples living in these places. So it's almost like a sort of fractal complexity, that the degree of complexity remains constant across different scales. You go from the macro to the micro. So what he made manifest was the fractal complexity of place. So one of the things that I think is very interesting in terms of travel practices in this, imagine this kind of inverted university, is what has been called by some activists deep mapping. And so you would look at the site where your university is, and then you would begin to look at the geological history of that site, the botanical history of that site, the historic history of that site, the linguistic, and so on. So, and then, of course, what you do is that the more and more you dig, the more and more you realize the extraordinary complexity of any one place, but also, of course, how the complexity of any one place connects it to all kinds of other places. You find traces of all kinds of peoples and languages and cultures that have come into that place, of migratory species that have traveled thousands of miles to be there, of other species that have gone to travel hundreds of miles to leave there to go somewhere else. And so it's making that complexity more manifest. So that, I think, is in terms of a different paradigm, using the vertical paradigm of travel. But in terms of horizontal travel itself, one of the things that I think we have to think about is, I've spent all of my life working in translation and languages, and we encourage our students to travel, to go to the countries where the languages are spoken and experience those countries. But I think now we have to think about our sustainable forms of travel for those students. And if these sustainable forms of travel, and because I live on an island, getting off the island, if I take a plane, it doesn't take me very long. But if I take a boat, the nearest is 3 hours to Wales. But if I want to go to France, it's going to be 18 to 22 hours. And then I've just arrived at the coast, get a train to go somewhere else. So we have to change our conception of time. We have to, in terms of academic staff attending conferences, students going on exchanges, going on trips and so on, is we need to slow things down. We need to expand the amount of time that they will get in order to do this in a sustainable way. So I think that our kind of our temporal framing of our jobs and our activities and that need to change quite radically to embrace forms of travel that won't destroy the planet.
Yes, at least until technology catches up. And I just wanted to share because I'm very hopeful about this. And if anyone else told me that they're going to open up suborbital travel or whatever, like Bertrand Piccott, as I mentioned near the beginning of this conversation, I would say, oh, really? But he has done this thing with his three generations of explorer family. So that may be possible, as he says, the green hydrogen powered flights, or maybe further down the line, suborbital travel, which will even open up faster flights for long hauls from, it could be, you know, Dublin to Australia. But that's a little bit further down the line. I'm just saying I'm hopeful for that, but we have to slow ourselves down until we get there technologically, I believe. Just going back to you're just talking about the fractal nature of translation, and that goes into these innovative ideas you have, like hologrammatic translation and connecting diverse fields from literature to quantum physics. Could you just expand a little bit on that multi-layered perspective that you explore in your books?
Yeah, so I suppose in terms of how you think about place and the relationship to place and language, I mentioned earlier that Across the Lines book, and maybe just give you an example of how one's thinking evolves about something. I was struck by travelers who were traveling in a particular place, and they would often go to a remote island. And so this remote island wouldn't be very big. You could walk around the island in a day. And one of the recurrent features was that the surprise of travelers when they would talk to native inhabitants of the island, and they would say, oh, I haven't been over on the other side of the island in the last 10 years. And travelers, you know, how strange is this that you can do this so quickly? And I began to think about this in the context of an article that was written by a French mathematician called Benoît Montelbrot. And he asked this famous question, how long is the coast of Britain? You think, well, that's pretty simple. You just get a kind of a measuring tape and you run it around the coast of Britain and you add it all up and you get the length of the coastline of Britain. But then he said, well, there is a problem, because at one level, for example, from a plane, what looks like a straight line, when you see that line from bicycle or on foot, turns out to be not a straight line at all, but full of all kinds of indentations, all kinds of nooks and crannies. And so then you would have to get your tape measure again to measure all those tiny crooks. But then if you are a beetle or an ant, what looks like a straight line for a human walker is a hugely kind of complex in jagged world. So Montelbrot's challenge was, how do you measure across different scales? How do you take account of complexity across different scales? And his point, of course, being that complexity is constant across different scales. The traditional idea had often been is that you have complex phenomena, and then complex phenomena can be reduced to the simplest constituent element. But what Montelbrot argued is there is no such thing. That complexity goes all the way down. So I began to think about this in terms of particular kinds of traveling, that when people inhabit a particular place and spend many years there, they begin to engage in that kind of fractal traveling. They begin to see the sheer complexity of tiny or very restricted spaces. And what you find then when a more horizontal traveler comes from elsewhere, there's a kind of clash between those two different paradigms. And I wanted to take that notion then of fractal differentialism into our experience of language learning and translation, which is that one of the things that you realize when we first start learning a language, we learn the kind of the broad outlines, the kind of the brushstrokes of the language. We allow ourselves to basically negotiate the culture in which the language is spoken. But what you realize is that the more and more time you spend in that language, the more and more it's a fractal experience. It's the experience of more and more complexity you discover more and more things that you don't know. So the more and more you know about the language, the more you realize, the more you still don't know. And that, of course, is the experience of the translator when you're working with a language, is that you are constantly exposed to the fractal complexity. So it comes back to that hermeneutics of translation or translation hermeneutics that I mentioned to Evelyn a little earlier, is the ways in which the more you get to know a language, the more you realize all the potential meanings that any sentence or a word might have. You discover the sort of fractal complexity, and that becomes the real challenge for the translator in engaging in translation. So it's the way in which, if you like, sometimes you have an idea which is in one discipline, in the area of mathematics, but can then travel to other areas such as travel, language learning, translation, and so on, and illuminate them in different ways, as ways of trying to highlight aspects of our experience of this.
I agree. We need to open the silos of knowledge, and by exposing ourselves to cross-disciplinary learning, we gain new perspectives and insights that can help inform our worldview. And I just wondered, in closing, when we're a child, our backyard can be a place of exploration and wonder. So I'm wondering if you could share, what are some of your personal memories from childhood of the beauty and wonder of the natural world? And as you reflect on the future and education, what would you like young people to know, preserve, and remember?
Yes, I think probably my most vivid memories, or I grew up in the south of the city, but I grew up near it called the Dublin Wicklow Mountains. And so I spent a great deal of my teenage years in particular cycling through these mountains, and they're quite deserted. It's very strange because, you know, it's right beside this quite densely populated city, and yet you've got this extraordinary kind of open space. So I was captivated by particularly the changing colors, the way in which, because we have, it's an island, so we have very unstable weather patterns. So you get these remarkable kind of skies, cloud formations, and then what happens, the rain falls after the rain when the sun comes out. So it was intensely dramatic. It was intensely theatrical landscape. So that's what I remember most vividly, was the kind of the drama of this landscape and this world. And I think that sense of wonder, that and a kind of just fascination and awe at the possibilities of this world. This seems to me the most valuable thing of all that any educational system can communicate. And I think this is what students should be demanding, that rather than this kind of contemporary obsession with skills, which is always a doomed project because the world is changing so rapidly that the kinds of skill sets that almost are invariably obsolete. But what I think will stay with you for an entire lifetime is to be equipped with the capacity and the tools to find wonder in the world. And that is to find a language for that world, which is supplied through a folktale, mythology, literature, poetry, and song. And then to also to have the kind of knowledge basis. I still think we suffer from this terrible division between the humanities and the sciences. These two worlds are sundered. Is I think we need to bring them together, if you like, in order to enhance our sense of one. Anybody who has for a moment studied the operations of photosynthesis in a plant or capillary action in trees is just astonished by the miracle of these operations. So I think we need to infuse a kind of a syncretic knowledge, but that would have as its central or its core point of value a rediscovery of wonder in the world. And of course, a world that you wonder at is a world that you cherish. And a world that you cherish is a world that you want to preserve. And that, I think, is our only hope.
Thank you so much, Michael Cronin, for sharing that gift of your curiosity and your sense of wonder about the miracle of the more than human world. And these insights into preserving linguistic and ecological diversity, ethics, the digital age, and helping us just come to terms with the Anthropocene and our impact on this earth so we can create more equitable futures. We all live on one planet we call home. Thank you for adding your voice to One Planet Podcast and the creative process.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
One Planet Podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation. This interview was conducted by Mia Fuck and Evelyn Mall with the participation of collaborating universities and students. Associate interviews producers on this episode were Sam Myers and Evelyn Moll. One Flooded Podcast is produced by Mia Funk. Additional production support by Sophie Garnier. Theme music is written and performed by Juan Sanchez. We hope you've enjoyed this program. If you'd like to get involved in One Planet Podcast and be part of the climate change solution, just drop us a line at team@oneplanetpodcast.org. Thank you for listening.